B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. The date? October 25th, 1999. It's a day that I and most golfers who were alive at the time will never forget. That was the day that a Learjet 35 carrying five souls, including Payne Stewart, perished in a terrible aviation accident. Today, we devote the entire show to the man who passed away an American hero from both the 1999 U.S. Open at Pinehurst and the Miracle at Brookline Ryder Cup team. We'll speak with golf historian Peter Kessler, who was with Payne just a week before his passing and tells a tale of that encounter from Scotland that will raise the hair on your arms. Lee Patterson, the director of media relations for the PGA Tour in 1999, who had to deal with that tragedy both professionally at the Tour Championship in Houston and personally, as Payne was a good friend. But we begin today with a familiar name and voice on this show. Kevin Robbins is a professor at the University of Texas and a few years ago wrote the definitive biography of legendary coach Harvey Penick. This week, his latest book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, hit bookstores. Kevin, I know you've been working on this book for at least 2 years because I remember us talking about you working on this book for at least 2 years. When did the idea come to you and why? Were you looking down the line at the 20-year anniversary of Payne's death, or what was the impetus for you to write this book?
Well, that wasn't really the impetus. It was kind of a nice coincidence, I guess, that we could finish it up in time for the anniversary when Payne was top of mind again. And so I wasn't really looking hard for another book idea, Charlie, but I was in front of my computer. It was a Saturday night in November of 2016, I think, and I just accidentally came across the final National Transportation Safety Board report of the flight and of October 25th, 1999, the one carrying Payne Stewart and five other people, including two pilots. And, you know, as government reports are, it was very detailed. There was not a story there, but there sure was a story to be told from this document, I thought. And the document had been released in its final form in 2005. So it came after the initial journalism about the death of Payne Stewart. Payne's wife Tracy had written the authorized biography. So I wondered if there were new ground to cover. There was lots. And also, I'm from Kansas City. I grew up in Missouri. Payne Stewart was someone I kept an eye on, and being from my home state. And so that's really how it started. And it started as a book about the flight of October 25, 1999. I should be transparent here. My agent quickly determined that wasn't a good book topic. It was a good magazine story, maybe, but not a book topic. So I just started looking deeper, and I looked backward, and I thought about that season, and it was really such a good season in golf. The major championships were historic, each in its own way. And so that's how it began, and here we are.
The book is entitled The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, and that title takes on many different meanings when you read the book. It was his last year on tour, the last year of his career. It was the last moments of his life, that flight. There was the Ryder Cup concession to Colin Montgomery, sort of the last stand of golf congeniality in that. And then there was the last stand of his particular style of golf. And you go into detail about that, him and the Hal Suttons and the Azingers. This was 1999 as we were, you know, sort of segueing from the wound ball to the solid core ball, and the guys who played by feel, Corey Pavins in that group too, as opposed to the guys who began to overpower golf courses, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, etc. When did the title come to you, and when it did, was it after you had already considered all of these different things, or did it just sort of happen to fit that narrative?
It came rather late, actually. I think I was probably midway through the story, and it was untitled. I was thinking about a season narrative, a story of a season, and it's not so much that Payne was staging a stand, really. I don't see him as an aggressor. I see him almost as a defendant, and he was resisting this wave of he and his peers of that generation, and I would define that as players born before 1960. He was defending the game against this wave that was powerful and inevitable and unrestrainable, and it was personified by a 23-year-old Tiger Woods, and behind him, with him, 29-year-old Phil Mickelson and 19-year-old Sergio Garcia. These are all field players too. I want to be clear about that. They have their own sense of feel. But my point in making this part of Payne's story is that Payne Stewart and Sutton and O'Meara and Tom Lehman, Ben Crenshaw, Corey Pavin, as you mentioned, they learned golf with hard equipment to play: steel shafts, forged iron heads, persimmon woods, wound balls. The next generation, the younger guys, they learned with the equipment that made golf an easier game to play and that makes possible the golf that we see now on our televisions every weekend, when Brooks Koepka hits a 3-wood 350 yards and Dustin Johnson plays par fives with wedges. So that's my point. I think there are both kinds of field players, but the field player in Payne Stewart and his generation, they had to learn a different kind of feel to move the ball around accurately with the equipment they learned with.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. As you look back on Payne Stewart's life, he was a much more complex individual than I remembered. And as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, you know, may we all benefit from the gift of history as Payne Stewart has. We all remember the guy winning the U.S. Open, kicking his fist and his foot in the air, and then immediately embracing Phil Mickelson and telling him, you know, none of this matters. You're going to be a father, and that's what matters. We remember the concession to Colin Montgomery. We remember him sort of segueing into the position of golf's statesman of what's right and wrong in the game. We forget, this is a guy who was capable of immature and often boorish behavior, even in the process of winning major championships, in addition to being a guy who was capable of donating his entire paycheck for winning a tournament to a children's hospital. Is it fair? I guess that may not be the word, but when you're looking back on a life, should we concentrate on where he ended up more than where he came from? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and yes, I think you do. I think that's the way you judge all people, is how they were in the end. We're all evolving all the time. We're all moving in one direction, sometimes imperceptibly, but you know, we're either getting better or getting worse. And we're either improving or we're not. And Payne was, demonstrably. He showed people in 1999 through his actions and his words, but mainly through his actions, that he had grown up. So, yeah, look, Payne as a young man, he ran hot. He didn't know how to manage his emotions, which is something that most elite athletes learn to do. Not all, but most. And that's how they achieve greatness. And Payne achieved greatness despite that. He still was an emotional man, I believe, in 1999. But he had learned to control and manage and mitigate the emotions that had gotten him into trouble as a young man. And so, but back to your point, yeah, I think we judge somebody by who they were in the end. We have to consider their entire body of work, their entire lives. And that also is, to my mind, what makes Payne more admirable in 99, is where he had been.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. When I was talking with some friends last weekend after a golf round about your book and about the conversation we would be having, this phrase, this term came up, and please don't think I'm intending it to have the same worldwide impact, but this was, for a lot of us, especially golf fans, this was a sports JFK moment. By that, I mean everyone who was alive in 63 knows where they were when they heard the news that the president had been assassinated. For my generation, there are two. There was the Challenger explosion in 84. There was, of course, 9/11. I remember exactly where I was for both things. And as we were discussing this in a sports world, all of us remembered where we were or what we were doing that fall morning in 1999 when we heard about Payne Stewart's aircraft. Do you think that's a fair comparison to make?
Well, I wouldn't compare it in scale or scope to 9/11. Or
No. That's what I'm saying. Don't take it the wrong way. But just in terms of people remembering where they were when they heard the news.
Yes, that's true. Everybody I've ever talked with about this book, from the people I interviewed to friends, you know, who don't, students of mine, whose parents have talked about it. Yes, they do. And I do wonder why that is. I think the first reason is it was so unusual and it was so mysterious. And I remember I was a reporter in St. Louis at the Post-Dispatch. We were gathered around a TV in the South County Bureau watching this thing unfold. And it went on for so long, Charlie. It was like 3 hours of televised uncertainty. And there was a plane, a Learjet 35, carrying a famous athlete. No response from inside the cockpit. And no one knew how it would end. Was this plane going to fly forever? Was it going to crash in Des Moines? It seemed like one of those days where anything was possible. And just the intrigue of it all and the building sense of doom. This clearly was not going to end well. And no one at that time, in the moment, knew if anybody was alive on the plane. It turns out they were not. They had perished pretty early in the flight from a lack of oxygen. And by the time they hit the Florida-Alabama line, they were dead. But nobody knew that at the time. And so, yes, we remember that with great clarity because it was jolting.
The book opens with and I read it twice because it was so stunning. Most of the time, I skip over prologues of books. I just say, whatever that is, I don't care. I'm moving to chapter one. Do not skip the prologue of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. It is a riveting account of that flight and of what, since none of us will ever really know what happened, it is as riveting an account of what probably happened as you will ever read. As I was reading it, I was wondering, who all were you able to talk to? Did you speak to the fighter pilots that were dispatched? Who did you talk to? Air traffic controllers who were on duty at the time, or did you just get that strictly from the National Transportation Safety Bureau report?
All of it came from the report.
Wow!
I just coughed. There was no need to talk to those people who had this very incidental and temporary involvement in that day. Plumbing their memories 20 years later probably wasn't going to produce anything beyond what was in. And this is how detailed that report was. Entire transcript of communications to the plane, from the plane, all air traffic control communication to outbound and inbound airline pilots who were nearby in the airspace, all radio transmissions between the military pilots and their commanders on the ground. That kind of in-the-moment, authentic primary source conversation really made that, I think, that section just terribly dramatic. It was kind of hard to pull back on some. I mean, there was more detail that I thought bordered on the gratuitous, but it was really hard to know where that line was.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim. We mentioned the fact that early in his career and really even when he started winning major championships, Payne could be quite a pistol at times and didn't make the best decisions from a behavior standpoint. There was a moment in his life, and I got to thinking about this as I was reading your book, that in a way mirrors Tiger Woods. Follow me on this. For better or for worse, Earl Woods was sort of Tiger Woods' true north. He was his moral compass, not in his own actions, but in his words. He was a do as I say, not as I do kind of guy. And you can point to the unraveling of Tiger's personal life almost to the day that Earl Woods passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Bill Stewart was the guiding force in Payne Stewart's life, his true north. And he passed away before Payne realized the great success of his professional career. And I just wonder, as I was reading your book, I was wondering if he would have lived, do you think that there would have been someone to pull Payne back and say, boy, what are you doing? Stop this.
That's a really, really good question. So I never knew Payne Stewart, and I never knew Bill Stewart. Now, I did visit with Payne's sisters for quite a long time on a couple of occasions, including a personal visit to Springfield, Missouri. And we got in the car and went all over town to see the different places where that Payne had been a part of. I think that Bill Stewart probably was more level and perhaps a better role model than Earl Woods. I try to be really careful in speculating. It's not what I'm.
No, that's probably knowing what we know. That's probably a safe speculation.
Yeah. And I, Bill Stewart was a big presence too, and a big personality. He was a salesman. He's the one who suggested to Payne that he adopt some kind of look in terms of his wardrobe in order to be better remembered, to have a style, you know, have a brand. But I guess I would get the sense that Bill Stewart was a more sensible, level-headed, self-aware person who might have pulled his son aside and said a few words. That's really hard to say. It's a fascinating question, though.
Kevin, Tracy Stewart wrote a book. I was talking with someone the other day. You know, it's weird how it's been 20 years. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us, these people are frozen in time. Aaron Stewart's a grown man who's about to become a tournament director for an LPGA event. And when I was told that, my first reaction was, what do you mean he's 10? You know, to me, he'll always be that little boy who was there at the service. Tracy wrote a book. Did you have any contact with the family? Did you get the blessing from the family? Has there been any contact with Chelsea, Aaron, or Tracy on this book?
I did get Tracy's blessing to proceed. I thought that was important. I figured probably rightly that the people closest to Payne Stewart would be reluctant to talk with me if Tracy were unaware of the book or didn't approve of the project in the beginning. With that blessing, Tracy told me that through a letter that she didn't want to do any more interviews. I was fine with that because I wrote this book about what was happening in 99, and anything that really happened in the future, I didn't include. So there's no one looking back and reflecting on anything that happened in 99 or what Payne meant to the world of golf or anything like that. It's a very in the moment kind of story. And for that reason, also, I didn't need to talk to Tracy or to Chelsea and Aaron. They were 10 and 12 at the time. Their memories of that day, while I'm sure they remember some things, and those would be very painful to recount, their presence in the story didn't require me to do an interview with them, if that makes sense.
No, well, fair enough.
I wanted to talk with people who were present and part of it in 99. And most of the book, as you know, takes place on the golf course or between tournaments or something like that. October 25th, 99 takes up some pages in the book, as do the following 4 days. And the book's over on that Sunday after Tiger Woods wins the tour championship. That's the end of the story. So the bulk of the interviews I did were with people like players, his caddy, Mike Hicks, his coach, Chuck Cook, his friends back in Dallas, who were present and had a part in Payne's life in 1999. So Tracy and I did speak. She did read the manuscript before copy editing. She corrected some errors. I'm grateful for that. And her overall, I feel like I can paraphrase her overall impression of the book, that she thought that I used too many negative media portrayals of Payne. And that's fair. You know, like I think to myself, if this story were about my spouse, I probably would be disappointed too. And as the writer of this book, I probably would have been in more peril and more trouble if Tracy Stewart had loved the story, because then I wouldn't be beholden to the truth. I'd be doing another authorized biography.
get you out of here on this. Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim, a person who is, to me, a prominent, if it's possible to be a prominent person in the background, he is, and he's mentioned several times in the book. He was a big presence at the Ryder Cup, and I'm speaking of Hal Sutton, and because of the proximity of their names alphabetically, Stewart and Sutton, they many times were lockered right next to each other, week in, week out on the PGA Tour, and as such, there was a relationship between those two guys. The last time we spoke, you had just written a brilliant piece on Hal Sutton, I believe for Golf Digest, and we spoke at that time. I'm sure you had more than one conversation with Hal Sutton about Payne Stewart, or maybe you didn't. It struck me that Hal Sutton's the kind of guy who, once he had spoken on the subject, he had spoken on it. We weren't going to talk about it anymore. And he's sort of like the last John Wayne left in this town. And he got up and rode off. Did Hal have anything to say, or did he sort of look at you and say, Kevin, I love you, but everything I've said is on the record somewhere else?
No, we did speak. Hal Sutton is a very eloquent storyteller. And in one of the interviews that we did for this book, he started remembering that Saturday night at the Ryder Cup. And that is a story that has been told from a lot of different points of view over the years. It was the team meeting after Ben Crenshaw wagged his finger at the press conference and said something about fate. The American team was down 10-6, looked insurmountable for a single Sunday. But they needed something. They needed something to hold on to. And so Saturday night, they went around the room, each player, and talked about why that moment was important to them. They couldn't talk about the golf. The golf seemed so beside the point. And Hal told me this story about breaking down walls. And he described how on the PGA Tour, because it's an individual sport, players don't really reveal much in a soul way to their peers, because there's this, it really is quite irrational, but there's this idea that if I tell you who I really am, you're somehow going to use that against me on the golf course. If I tell you my secrets, you're going to reveal them on the golf course. It's a strange, strange thing, but I get it. And that night, those walls came down. And my sense of the story is that, yeah, Hal and Payne knew each other because of the proximity of their lockers, but not until that Saturday night did they really know each other. And they stayed up late. They were the last two guys standing. And they decided, well, they were going to do this together and that. They were going to go fishing, and Hal was going to teach Payne how to ride a horse. And when they became Ryder Cup captains, the other would be the vice captain. They made plans. They had dreams. And a month later, Payne got on the plane.
I cannot recommend The Last Stand of Payne Stewart highly enough. That's author Kevin Robbins. And up next, Lee Patterson, former director of media relations for the PGA Tour, takes dead aim at what had to be one of the worst weeks of his life 20 years ago, both professionally and personally, as a friend of Payne Stewart's. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. As I was finishing up Kevin Robbins' book on Payne Stewart, a familiar name jumped off the pages. Current Director of Media Relations for the Wells Fargo Championship, Lee Patterson. This week, 20 years ago, he was the Director of Media Relations for the PGA Tour. And that week, it had to be tough. Lee, as I was just mentioning off air, I've known you forever as the Director of Media Relations for the Wells Fargo Championship, and I knew that you did the same job for the PGA Tour. I was just unaware of the timeline. When were you the Director of Media Relations for the Tour?
From about 1988, fall of 1988, until 2002, to help start this tournament.
All right.
So
before we get to Payne, which is the big subject today, looking at this timeline, and especially towards the end there, you were around to watch it all explode, I believe, between 99's PGA Championship and the end of the year 2000. Tiger won 17 tournaments and 4 out of 5 major championships contested over that period of time. What was it like in terms of media credential requests alone, the jump between the beginning of 1999 and the end of 2000 as Tiger really started to take off? How did your job become much more complicated just by his ascension?
Well, yeah, obviously we had more people every week, more media coming. And, you know, after he won that Masters, I think the next stop was Byron Nelson, and we had a couple more media folks that stayed inside the media tent. And I actually walked every hole with him just to keep the media in place inside the ropes. We had that many following.
Wow.
So that would happen for a couple of weeks after that. So, yeah, it just the attention went from, you know, back then we had golf writers and national golf writers, and every paper had a golf writer. And it went more to the mainstream news, more to, you know, other just the CNNs of the world suddenly were coming out. You know, so we had a lot more of mainstream media covering golf. So it did explode.
Yeah. Wow.
We had to build bigger media, and we had to add more seating in a lot of the media centers. You know, everything got just larger.
Lee Patterson is the Director of Media Relations for the Wells Fargo Championship, formerly Director of Media Relations for the PGA Tour, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's take you back to the year 1999, specifically the end of 99 and the Tour Championship held at Champions Golf Club, which is where I grew up in Northwest Houston, full disclosure. And it was your week got off to a very ominous, crazy, and just a bad start. For those that don't know, I don't care if it's the PGA Championship, I don't care if it's the Wells Fargo Championship. If there is one day that is kind of calm and easygoing during the week for the media and those involved with covering and the players, it is Monday. Monday is the easiest day on you and everyone associated with the tournament. That particular Monday, I imagine, with the limited field, you woke up that morning and said, you know, this is going to be a fairly easy day. And then things started to turn south about 9:30 in the morning. When were you aware or made aware that there was a problem with Payne Stewart's aircraft?
I was actually flying there myself, and once I landed, I got a call from the advanced rules official on site, and he told me to he told me something was wrong. We think we got a couple of players at the time, didn't know who, on an airplane that was in trouble, and he said, you need to come to me in the rules office immediately. We're going to have a meeting. So transportation me up from the airport, and I went right there, found out later what had happened, and yes, suddenly we had media coming out of the tournament site. And it's funny to say, I actually was with Melanie Hauser, who at the time was the Houston Chronicle
right.
Golf writer. I was with her last week, and you know, we were talking about, you know, all of a sudden TVs were showing up, national TVs were showing up, CBS, NASA. I mean, and yeah, it was kind of a surreal day, especially having been friends with Payne. So it was a little bit of personal as well as a work day. So very odd, very very different kind of week.
Well, and you know this, and I know this. Those that are on the gypsy train that is the PGA Tour week in, week out, it's a very small fraternity when you get right down to it.
Yeah,
and you see the same people every week, whether it be players, whether it be caddies, whether it be full-time tournament officials, and it's a family wagon train that's out there week in, week out. And I cannot imagine what all was going through your head. Again, not just because it was a player, but this is someone, you were there from 88 to 2002. You had seen Payne Stewart become the man in full that he became. And I imagine with his love of fishing, and I know how much you love fishing, there was more than one conversation about fishing, or maybe more than one line wedded between the two of you over the years. What was it? How were you able to get through that day? How were you able to push through? Or did you have to walk away at some point and kind of gather yourself for a few minutes?
Well, it's funny. Yeah, I actually just told myself Payne would want me to do my job. So that's kind of where that was. I just wrapped my head around that, and I didn't get to go back to Orlando for the funeral, and but I needed to stay. We actually shut the tournament down that day, and then I stayed back just to make sure everything was okay on site and any media needs. But I just kept saying to myself, Payne would be proud of me for just doing my job.
Lee Patterson's the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship. He was the tournament director for the PGA Tour in 1999. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. There's several images from that week that have remained with me throughout my lifetime, and especially as a boy who grew up there. Houston in the northwest side, we're not known for fog. It doesn't happen all that much. And the surreal moment of the opening ceremonies of the Tour Championship and that opening day and the bagpiper who came out and played, and then as he played Amazing Grace, he turned and disappeared into the fog. I've never forgotten that. Was the hair standing up on your arms watching it happen?
Oh, yeah. And Tom Lehman said a few words on the tee there as we were doing that, and I can tell you there were a lot of tears, but there were a lot of smiles because you know, we're like, gee, this is something that reminds us of Payne. You know, him kind of, he was a jokester, but he was also one of those that just liked to come to a room and make a special entrance and then he'd be gone. So it was very, very emotional, but it was also, you know, that's kind of when we started going, okay, we're going to celebrate the way Payne would want us to celebrate life.
The logistics of that week got very complicated very fast. You mentioned that you shut down the tournament on Friday for the memorial service that was back in Orlando. You played 27 holes on Thursday. Then there was a chartered plane for all the players and families and caddies and whatnot to head back to Orlando on Friday morning. They were there for the service, then came back. Then there were 27 holes on Saturday, and the hope was to have 18 on Sunday and get things finished up. I know how much weather makes us all panic anyway. You had to really be panicking with this sort of schedule.
Yeah, and in fact, you might, I'd forgotten all that. I'm glad you do your research, but as you always do. In fact, we actually had one of the first World Golf Championships over in Spain the next week, which we had a charter flight that I went to that. And so, yeah, we had to be done because we had to get to Spain for one of the first WGC match play events. So it was, they were worried about getting it finished.
Lee, how long did it take, in your observation, before things seemed to get back to normal on the PGA Tour in terms of the way players reacted with one another, the jocularity that was normally in the locker rooms and in the media rooms? I imagine it came, this is an awful sentence to say, but I don't know how else to say it. Maybe it came at an opportune time, Payne's death, because it was at the end of a season and you had a couple of months back then before things kicked back up. When the season resumed back in Hawaii, were things pretty much back to normal?
You know, they were. I mean, obviously, you know, every tournament, especially when we went back to Texas or something, would have something in honor of Payne, but, you know, some special service or commemoration or something. But, no, you know, the players and the staff, I mean, I can tell you everybody was a little leery about getting on planes for a while. I know that, but, you know, which is rightfully so. But, you know, we bounced back pretty fast. And again, it was the spirit of Payne Stewart. I mean, he would not want people, you know, being down and out. That wasn't him. So his spirit of uplifting and happy and smiling and cutting up and all that, and, you know, and he played in the band with some of the tour players that ended up making a few lousy songs, I can say, but Peter Jacobson and
Mark Lye,
yeah. So, you know, that's what everybody thought. I mean, we miss him dearly, but you know, it was this pain we want us to celebrate life and move on.
Get you out of here on this. Lee Patterson is the director of media relations for the Wells Fargo Championship. Held a similar position on the PGA Tour from 1988 to 1992. That time period is, and I think I mentioned a minute ago, is really Payne's life in full on the PGA Tour. He won his first major in 89, his second in 91, and, of course, his final one in 99. And over that period of time, you saw a very different man. Not that he wasn't a good time guy all along. I mean, it seems to me that the best of Payne Stewart was always the best of Payne Stewart. It was just that there was a very complex side of Payne that needed to mature. And just to get your thoughts on what it was like to see someone who you knew that period of time, a man that you saw go from one extreme to really another in about 10 years.
Yeah, well, and you know, he could be a little pith man, I can tell you that. But once you got to know him and you got to really, he started respecting you for what you were telling him he had to do. He'd be a little pouty for a while, but he'd come back. But yeah, he was, you know, during that time on the tour, still somewhat is. I just see younger kids now with no fear. Those guys were intense. They were, Greg Norman walk into a room, you know, Secretary, Raymond Floyd, they wouldn't talk to each other. They might go out to dinner later or do something, but when they were on the golf course or the tournament site, you know, they were there to beat you. And he was one of those. He was like that. But away from it, you know, we go to eat Mexican or something in Fort Worth, and I had a date, and he goes, "What are you doing with her? What you doing with him?" You know, he'd always tease you and try and make you look bad from somebody. But other than that, he was down there. If he was a really good guy, he really was.
Currently, he is the director of media relations for the Wells Fargo Championship, and formerly of that same position with the PGA Tour. That's my good friend Lee Patterson. And when we return, golf historian and master storyteller Peter Kessler takes dead aim at the life of his friend, Payne Stewart, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Peter Kessler, as host of the Golf Channel's Golf Talk Live, was the definitive interviewer of record in the game of golf in 1999. And he was also a good friend of Payne Stewart's. Peter, what do you think, 20 years later, what comes into your mind, what phrases, what thoughts, when you hear the name Payne Stewart?
Well, it was 20 years ago this week that I sat with Payne Stewart on the Sunday at the old course on the steps behind the 18th green at the conclusion of his singles match in the Dunhill Cup, an event that preceded the Dunhill Links where 3 players from each country would represent their countries. And it was a complicated stroke match play format, but it was played on, you know, great golf courses, obviously. And so Payne came and sat down with me after he had completed his singles match. And there's 3 little steps in the back of the 18th green at the old course, which you walk up to start to leave the property, or you go to your left to go back towards the first tee and the starter and so forth. So Payne sat down with me, and we were supposed to have done television a couple of weeks before, but he had unfortunately done a child's impression of somebody speaking Chinese, which did not go over well with the masses. So he ducked out of our interview because he knew I'd had to bring it up. But I wouldn't have. I didn't care either way. He was my friend. You know, it wasn't a big enough event that it was critical to bring up that issue. So we sat there, and he said, "Look, I'm so sorry that, you know, that I missed the show." And he said, "And I did that stupid thing." And he said, "So look, it's here we are, you know, almost the middle of October now." And he said, "You know, you and I will both be in November, and we'll both be in Orlando in November." And he said, "I'm going on a trip in a couple of weeks to Houston for a few days, and I'm playing." He said, "Then when I come back, that'll be early November. So let's play golf, and then let's go do your show, and then let's go have dinner and drink, and you'll have to drive me home." And he said, and he looked at me and he goes, "Just remember, Peter, we have all the time in the world.
That is what I remember you telling me, and I we've talked about this before, and how I've asked you, did that haunt you? And it doesn't haunt you, but it would just, that would resonate in my brain forever. And any time I heard his name, I would hear him say, "We have all the time in the world," and I think I would be overcome by great sadness. But you're not.
Well, I mean, in retelling the moment, you know, to me, it feels like a poignant one, and you know, it's something that stands out in my life as a very strong and powerful memory. But equally so was the relationship we had. Now, it was fairly brief because I didn't meet Payne until 1995, and of course, he passed in October of 1999. But between those two dates, we had a lot of stuff go on. We played a bunch of golf. I played in his chariot event. We had dinner a number of times. He went out drinking. I mean, guys and women would, like, crawl over you to get near him. It was insane. It was a little like being with Arnold when I first knew Arnold, when he's still looking particularly great in his mid-60s. And people would just, it was crazy. If we'd go out to dinner, women were completely insane. They didn't even know that you were there. They'd just try to crawl over you to get to him. And then guys would just, like, bring chairs on their table and, like, join Arnold's table with me. I mean, and he put up with it great, and, you know, got everybody, you know, he gave everybody signatures, and then he would always look at me and he would say, "I suppose you want an autograph." And I said, "Why would I want your autograph?" I said, "Why would I want your name on a piece of paper?" I said, "I'm your friend. I hang out with you. I couldn't be any less interested in that dopey stuff. And if you ever send me anything again, by the way, that includes a Palmer after the Arnold, I'm sending it back, return to sender." That's an Elvis song. You remember? Always, "Oh, I knew Elvis." He said, "We went out one night," and the rest of the story is X-rated. But you know, that's the way that people felt about Payne. That, remember, Princess Caroline of Monaco met Payne, and they were at a cocktail party, and she walked away for a minute and stood with a group of friends, and she said, "Boy, he really is the cat's meow, isn't he?" And he was. He was extraordinarily handsome, and from every angle, he was extremely fit. He looked great in clothes. He had a beautiful walk that was totally unaffected, and of course, the golf swing was partially God given. It was such a thing of great beauty to watch. It was, you know, very Bobby Jonesy, and it was almost drowsy, you know, Ernie Els a little bit, almost a drowsy feeling. But funnily enough, if you compare Ernie Els's swing speed to, say, Greg Norman's, who you think is significantly faster, it's the same swing speed. But because Ernie's sequence, his rhythm, the sequence of events that happen during a swing is so near perfect that it blends together into what we aesthetically think of as rhythm. Greg's appears to be faster and harder because it's not the same sequence, so it doesn't give off the same impression of rhythm. But Payne's swing always gave off the impression of rhythm, and he's always just trying to hit stuff at 80%. And, you know, I was with him, you know, at the U.S. Open just, you know, a few months before he died when he won up at Pinehurst. And on Sunday, the last three people on the range before Payne went to play his round with Phil Mickelson were me, his caddy, Mike Hicks, and Payne. And Payne had gone up to the first tee and gotten a pair of scissors so he could shorten the sleeves on his windbreaker. He wanted the warmth on his torso, but he didn't want the bulk on his arms. And so he was so fussed about being handsome that when we got down to the range, he had taken the scissors with him. And instead of hitting balls to warm up for the final round of the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, he's like looking at it like he's a tailor, snipping a little piece here, snipping. And I said to him, "Dude," I said, "this isn't happening." I said, "You know," I said, "if you don't, you know," I said, "I know you have a round of golf to play today," I said, "but there's no reason we can't work on my swing right now. So if you're just going to, you know, fool around, let me hit a couple 8-irons. I'm trying to draw it." And, you know, we had a good laugh. It was ridiculous. I said, "If you're not going to hit, then I'll hit." I said, "the whole big thing of brand new golf balls here. You're not," I said, "you don't care about anything." So after the round was over, he like sought me out, and actually he did the thing that he did with Phil kind of to me, where he took my face and put it in his hands. In this case, he just looked at me and said, he goes, "I guess you'll be wanting to see me tonight." And I said, "You betcha." And I said, "How proud do you think the old man would be?" And he went, "Real effing proud." So we were able to have one of those really cool moments where you were able to express the joy of the moment, but also the bittersweet memory that immediately joins up with it to create a new sensation internally. And Payne had already internalized by that moment, whether he had had it before, I'm sure he thought of his dad during the day, and I'm sure he thought of Matthew One, but it may have been the first conversation he had where somebody made him say something, and then just super tears came in his eyes. And remember, we had now been friends for 5 years, and I had seen him cry many times. I had made him cry intentionally many times. So this was not, this was a very familiar, comfortable situation for both Payne and for me, because he knew that that would be a secret moment. He knew I wouldn't repeat it in a way that would make him appear vulnerable or soft, or that he had confided in me and I let it out. And so it was just a super tender moment. And of course, on the day that he passed away, on the 25th, I was in Hawaii on an outing.
We'll get to that story here in just a second. The great Peter Kessler, golf historian, is our guest taking Dead Aim. You brought up the childish Asian imitation that occurred right before his death that kept him off your show. And looking back on Payne's life, this was a pattern, and he's such a complex person. It was such a dichotomy at times. You have this guy who was capable of extreme immature and at times boorish behavior, and yet this same guy was also capable of winning the Walt Disney tournament and turning around and donating the entire paycheck to a children's hospital. And yet these two men resided in the same body. I couldn't think of anybody else in golf that I had heard of that housed these two completely different personalities.
I would say people are more complicated than they seem to us on first blush. I mean, you look at somebody like Jack Nicklaus. He was fairly uncomplicated. He had his schedule. He had his German heritage that heavily influenced the way that he thought about things and organized things and did things. And he stayed faithful to going home every 2 weeks on the tour to be with his family, which, grew extremely large over time. And so, he didn't have issues, but everybody has stuff. I mean, Lee Trevino had to deal with alcoholism. Tom Watson had to deal with alcoholism. I mean, he had very serious problems. Payne drank an extraordinary amount. And everybody's got their demons, and everybody's got their sides. I mean, you take a larger-than-life figure like Babe Ruth. Okay, here's one of the, for sure, handful of greatest hitters that ever lived, definitely, no matter any way you look at it, statistically, contribution to team, anything like that. And he had all sorts of behaviors that were contrary. He could be rude, and he could be boorish, and he ate too many hot dogs, and he was with too many women, and he drank too much, but he was the sweetest guy in the world. He lived down in children's charities always. There's a million pictures of him with kids in his prime, in the hospital, in the famous story of saying, not only am I going to hit one home run for you today, Billy, I'm going to hit two home runs for you today. And then he went out to the ballpark and did it. So people are much more complicated than we perceive them to be, particularly people who are stars in some way. There's a lot of onlyness to it. There's a lot of loneliness to it. There's a lot of thinking about yourself going on. So I don't find it at all surprising that Payne was the way Payne was. And quite frankly, he was a super kid. I mean, he drank too much. He, we had Peter Jacobson and Payne and all the guys from Booker T and the MGs come in, when they were Jake Trout and the Flounders. And Payne was just way past gone. And he was sitting in a chair playing harmonica, and Peter was playing acoustic guitar and singing lead vocals on these parody songs. But every line that Peter sang, Payne would repeat it, and Peter just kept looking at him like daggers, like, shut up, dude. And then at some point, Payne is looking around trying to find some more, Bombay Blue Sapphire gin, because he'd run out just before the show started. We went into a deep panic. So, everybody's got their stuff. But you take the whole Payne package, and you whip it up. It's just a pretty cool souffle.
Peter Kessler, golf historian, our guest taking Dead Aim. As we look back at Payne's career, which of these sentences best describes him, or is it perhaps somewhere in the middle? Was he a good player who eventually maximized his potential? I say eventually because, he had so many second place and third place finishes at the beginning of his career. Or was he a great player who, although accomplished, perhaps underperformed?
I would say he was a late bloomer who was going to get to five majors, who could have been considered an all-timer. You can't consider him an all-timer now because his career was cut off. So, you know, he's got the three major championships and a bunch of tour wins, but really he was playing right then some of his best golf and in his early 40s. I mean, remember, he had just lost to Lee Jansen at Olympic the year before, and then he wins at Pinehurst. He plays some beautiful golf just before that at the Ryder Cup. Payne was in super-duper good shape. He was a young 42, and he felt that he had a renewed lease on life, that he had found God, that he had discovered the importance of family, that he had set some things aside. All that was true, but a little bit. These were not wholesale changes. You know, he just like everybody else, you make a step forward here, you make a step forward there. But, you know, so he really felt like he was in a rejuvenation period spiritually, not only with regard to religion or what you do or don't think about God, but just the way he felt inside about himself, his place in the world, and that leaving a little of the substance stuff behind him to the extent that it wasn't problematic, he felt that this was the beginning of a new chapter. So I feel he was cut down right at the point where I think we would have continued to, and I hate to say the word if, because no ifs in golf, there's only what happened, but if he'd been able to play another 5 years, I certainly think he would have picked up a couple more majors and six or eight more tournament victories. And at five majors, you're considered one of the best ever. At four, I don't think you are. At five, I think you are. There's got to be a cutoff. And so, you know, that's the number that I would place that Payne would have gotten to. So I would say he was a super player who was on his way with a few more key wins to being labeled for sure one of the best of his time and maybe one of the best ever if he had kept moving forward. You got to get to five or six to do it, though.
Golf historian Peter Kessler, our guest taking Dead Aim. Earlier, you mentioned that he had that magnetic charisma when he was in a room similar to Arnold Palmer. And it's interesting that you bring that up because, and like you, I hate the speculation game. So I'm not even going to use that term. I'm going to use the word hypothesizing. In addition to his golf career, I was hypothesizing that perhaps at this point, 20 years down the line, that Payne Stewart may have been the player to sort of slide into the Arnold Palmer role of guardian of the game at this point. I think we were, there's no question he would have been a Ryder Cup captain maybe once or twice. He loved the event. But I had a feeling that towards the end of his life, he was coming to terms with all of that, and he could have slid into that spot. I think he could have been great on TV as a commentator. Knowing what you knew about Payne then, if you were to hypothesize what he would have become after his playing career, what do you think he possibly could have done?
Well, I mean, we're cutting it short, too, because in my mind, you know, he passed at 42, so we would have certainly seen him play golf till he was 60, so We really wouldn't have had a sense of whether or not he would have elected to take on the celebratory nature of appearances as opposed to competitive appearances. And I think it's a very, very cool call on your part, Charlie, because I think of anybody, just off the top of my head as we're kicking it around now, he would have been the one guy who could do that. He would have been the one guy, you know, who everybody loved him. He had the incredible charisma. He had a beautiful natural touch with people and kids, and of course he had his own. But he would have been psychologically capable of slipping into that role where I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who might have better suited that position or would have been more inclined, for good reasons, for reasons that we would have said, yeah, this is good, would have done that. So, yes, I think that that was could have been a transition he would have easily made, given that he already transcended golf. You know, he enjoyed celebrity a little bit beyond golf, you know, towards the end of his life. And so that would have only grown, too. So in terms of being a goodwill ambassador, a statesman, a celebratory appearance guy, it would have worked beautifully. I agree with you, Charlie.
Peter, I was having a conversation after a round of golf the other day with some people I was playing with, and we were talking about Payne Stewart's plane crash, and I had it described to me, and I hadn't thought about it this way before, but I think it's an apt comparison. They said it was sort of a sports JFK moment. I was not around for JFK's assassination, but I remember where I was when the Challenger crashed. Of course, we all remember where we were on 9/11. It was one of those moments in sports. As far as plane crashes go, in golf, you had Tony Lima, I guess, in 66, Clemente's plane crash. When I was a boy, I remember Thurman Munson's plane crash, and then there was this, and I remember exactly where I was when Payne Stewart's plane was just drifting in the atmosphere, and so many of my friends knew exactly where they were in the place and time, and that was really one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today, because your story of where you were, as poignant as the moment was in Scotland the week before he died, the where you were and what was going on was kind of eerie to me as well.
Well, yeah, you know, there's a big difference to me between Payne Stewart's passing and the assassination of JFK. When I was in sixth grade, they had just made transistor radios available, and they had a single earplug with a wire that came out of the little thing that looked like an iPad or an iPhone, really, in size. And I remember I had it with me. I'm in my desk, but then I had the wire come out, ran it up my shirt, and listened to the radio during class in sixth grade. I was just a great student even then, and then the news came on the radio. He had been shot, and it was not clear that he had been declared dead yet. So I just took off my earpiece, and I set in, and I knew somebody was going to be coming down the hall. And sure enough, somebody came down the hall and talked to the teacher and dismissed us. And I was 11, and I spent, my parents were with us for the weekend watching it on TV, and I watched Jack Ruby kill Lee Harvey Oswald on Sunday and everything that happened the day before. And so, but it's completely different than Payne Stewart. You know, in one case, you've got a horrific international, something with international repercussions, an assassination of an American president. On the other hand, you have the tragic accident that happened to Thurman and to Tony.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm not comparing them in terms of historical importance, just in the fact that you remember where you were.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just saying that the visceral reaction was different because of the circumstance. But, you know, with Payne, it was 8 hours earlier because we're in Hawaii. And so we're on the range at 8 in the morning. Roger Maltby, me, Craig T. Nelson, a couple of movie actresses. And Chi-Chi comes out onto the range. And he goes, something's going on with Payne's airplane. It's out of control. They can't find it. But whatever it is, it's really bad. So Roger Maltby, who was hitting balls next to me, it's funny, I still remember to this day, he was hitting balls with untied shoelaces, and he hit a few balls, and then Chi-Chi came over. Now, Roger had just gotten close again, Payne, and so he had an immediate, strong reaction, and he just left the range and went to his room for the day, and some of us played. I remember playing, and a couple of people did not, but mostly they did. Everybody went, well, what else should we do? So we did our day, and then that night, Stephen Stills, you know, the great Stephen Stills from Buffalo Springfield and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Nash and Young, and so Stephen was there playing in the outing, and his guitar technician lived on an adjoining island, so he had the guy bring over some stuff, and so Stephen performed that night around just after dinner time. It was now just dark, and he was on a stage, and first he did a treetop blubber, I think. Treetop Flyer. Treetop Flyer was the name of Payne's favorite song, which I had never heard of. And so Stephen plays the song, Treetop Flyer, after saying that Payne was like a 12 handicapper on the harmonica. So as Stephen gets into the song, the moon rose directly behind his right shoulder. It was this crystal clear night in Hawaii. Dark sky, and it was a rather full moon. I couldn't swear that it was full, but it was significant, and we all watched it just rise over his shoulder, and afterwards, he maybe did 10 songs, and it was, of course, fantastic, and everything was dedicated to Payne. He asked if we had also seen the moon rise, and we said yes, and he said, you know, that was Payne going to heaven.
Just let that last line sink in. Wow. Golf historian Peter Kessler. I'd also like to thank former PGA Tour Director of Media Relations Lee Patterson and Kevin Robbins, author of the brilliant The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, for their time and insight this week. A reminder, just catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studio, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Weather-wise, well, fall weather and temperatures still in abundance and plenty of opportunity this weekend for teeing it up in the Carolinas and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.